From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Research from Bloomberg and Brookings rank Atlanta as the worst city in America for income inequality. The top 5% of households in the city earn nearly 20 times the income than the bottom 20%. And that widening gap leaves fewer people in the middle. Here's what Cardiff Garcia from Planet Money said on what that means.
If the people getting ahead are the owners of capital, we have to figure out a way to help middle-class people own more capital, too.
So what does that mean here in Atlanta and the wider state of Georgia? And how do we begin to address our bottom-scraping income inequality? Mersa Baradaran from UGA School of Law joins us at our bureau in Athens. She's author of The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. Mersa, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Alex Kammerdell is senior policy analyst. He's with the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, and he's among the author of the Institute's Inclusive Growth Report. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, so what does income inequality actually mean? What's being measured? Alex?
Sure. So we're actually talking about the concentration or the mass concentration of wealth and income in the top earners in Atlanta as well in the state. And whenever you actually do a critical analysis of who's raking in the most money, you realize that the other 99% of earners in the state are relatively far below what it takes to get by on a day-to-day basis in Georgia and in Atlanta in the metro area.
So what is the difference, Alex, between income and wealth?
Sure. So income is a useful measure of understanding how much a person brings home from a day-to-day job. Wealth is a little bit different, and it adds a lot more, I believe, texture to the conversation, because wealth is focusing on assets. You know, an example of an asset that is a huge marker for wealth for a lot of families in Atlanta and in Georgia and across the country is a home. And families that have an asset like a home are able to reinvest and transfer that wealth down generations and generations, whereas we can't actually point a finger on whether the transfer of income is having the same effect.
Mersa, I'm wondering, why did Atlanta take the top spot at the bottom? What is it about Atlanta that makes inequality more prevalent than in other places?
Well, one of the things you have to consider is when we're talking about wealth inequality, and I think wealth inequality is a much more important indicator of what it means to be at the bottom. Income is something that is much more flexible and can change within a lifetime, but wealth tends to be one of these things that's passed generationally and really it sort of has a sedimentation quality, right? Where if you have high wealth, you're likely to keep that wealth because capital, accrues much more sort of income than income itself. So that was one of the biggest takeaways from Thomas Piketty's work is that if you have a lot of wealth, so property, stocks, whatever, you're going to keep that wealth and it's going to produce much more income than just having a job that pays money. And so one of the things, if you look at Atlanta, there are some great maps available online, and you can look at exactly the way that Atlanta was segregated racially. And you have really wonderful sort of black areas like around Morehouse and Spelman. And if you go back to these 1934 redlined maps, the FHA and the HOLC created, and you can see how the government sort of bureaucrats came in and marked up Atlanta by zones. Green zones were places where people could get mortgages. Red zones were places where people couldn't. So even in the highest black neighborhoods in Atlanta were marked as red zones. Purely because of the racial makeup of that neighborhood. And you can see it in the forms. And it's something that's really illuminating if you go back. And so those trends in segregation and the effects that they have had on home ownership and the ability to accrue wealth have not been disrupted. And so we still have this bifurcated housing market. And one of the things we saw during the financial crisis of 2008 is where, when Wall Street gets a cold, Harlem gets the flu. And so when Wall Street got a cold this time, Atlanta, the places in Atlanta that were black, where finally the black population had been able to buy homes got hit the hardest. And those are places that have not recovered. So when we talk about the recovery, the banks have recovered just fine. But those homeowners that lost their homes lost them permanently. So that's these disruptions in home ownership are things that we generally don't tend to mark on general economic indicators, but they really have a dual effect on white homeowners versus black homeowners.
Alex, this is one of the things that your report looked at specifically, that the people of color could account for about 85% of new Georgians. This is over the next three decades. So we're here from Mersa, this idea, or the laid out quite clearly, this idea of multi-generational lack of wealth accruing. What does this mean for the future of Georgia? You are looking at policy. You are looking at initiatives. What kind of suggestions are you making?
Sure. And Mersa did a very great job of detailing kind of the institutional effects of not having wealth concentrated in folks who have disproportionately been locked out of the wealth building system. We tend to forget that we are still living in the shadow of Jim Crow, of even slavery. And a lot of the laws that we are still wrestling with today are laws that were on the books decades and decades ago that very blatantly restricted access to banks, to mortgage loans, as Mersa pointed out, to even, you know, everyday things like quality education, which, you know, folks will say is an opportunity to move up the economic ladder. And those are the types of things that are still we need to address directly through public policy. And not even just through public policy, but there are institutional and systems practices that are also routinely restricting folks from building wealth, such as the implicit biases that folks are dealing with whenever they go into a bank to open a regular checking account, or the biases at play whenever a brick and mortar bank or institution is determining whether or not to place its building in a majority black neighborhood or not. So those are the types of things that we need to address directly and are still wrestling with in 2018. And we are not doing a good job of getting away from that as we're approaching the 2030, timeline that we've laid out in our report around being a majority people of color state. And unless we are able to remedy some of these really crippling racial disparities in wealth and in income and really truly economic opportunity, then we are completely limiting the potential of Georgia.
That's Alex Kamerdel. He's senior policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Also with me, Mersa Baradaran. She's from UGA Law. She's also the author of a book specifically about black banking. And I wanted to get into that a little bit with you, Mersa. But first, this idea of we're talking about a lack of wealth growth in some populations, the unbanked, you know, people who don't have opportunities. But who is getting so much richer? Is that what's happening in our wealth gap, that a number of people or a small portion of people are getting so much wealthier and then people are staying at the bottom or going down? Mersa, do you have a handle on that?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, we have put in place policies over the last, you know, three decades. And this is apart from the racial sort of wealth gap segmentation, but we have policies put into effect where people of wealth can hold on to more of their wealth, pass more of that down to their children, and that their wealth is going to grow faster than people can make income. And so this is something that is broadly reflective of what we have decided as a society we're okay with, concentrations of wealth. So you see certain cities where this is really starkly apparent: New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, where you've got, you know, Atlanta less so, but some of these other cities, you've got multi-million-dollar, some billion-dollar properties, and people who are worth just astronomical levels of wealth, and then others who can barely make it. So this is something that we have allowed through policy. We've allowed it at the state level. We allow it through the local level, and we've allowed it at the federal level. And it's something that is really, really hard to detect on a day-to-day basis. But if you look at these trends over time, it's astonishing. And I think just one of the biggest sort of policy disasters. And it was abetted by, you know, bad economic theories. And, there's dark money involved, but it's not just, you know, conspiracies. It's also just, you know, this idea that if you make wealthy people wealthier, that there would be this trickle down effect and that they would be job creators. We don't talk about robber barons or aristocrats anymore. We talk about entrepreneurs and job creators, you know, as if Bezos being worth another, you know, billion will create more jobs, as opposed to using that billion to, you know, invest in public infrastructure. As an example, look at the Savannah public port, the Savannah created a public infrastructure project that has brought more jobs to the state than almost any other private company. And that was, public taxpayers having a long-term investment in a project that ended up creating so much wealth that the public could keep and keep reinvesting in that public space. So I think we need to, as a state, think much more about those kinds of investments.
So I want to follow up on that idea that this is something that is created through policy and something that we are okay with as a culture. But the American dream has always been, you know, somebody who gets ahead, give them all the power to get ahead. And then there's this middle class that is striving, that has continually growing. But we're talking about in a wide chasm between rich and poor, the middle class is sort of hollowed out. What does that mean in terms of growth and equality for you, Alex, as you study it?
Yeah, so the middle class is, you know, in many conversations that I've had recently about access to services, like something as simple as childcare or even transportation, they are having to make just as difficult a choice as folks who aren't even able to bring home an income. And that to us is a huge indicator of the systemic barriers that are facing working people generally, but especially those who are in the middle income band. The cost to live just without, you know, all the luxuries that many of us yearn for is incredibly high in a place like this whenever the incomes are not actually keeping pace. Over the last 10 years since the recession, Georgia has become well known for rapid economic growth. We've grown jobs and we've targeted job opportunities towards the middle income folks in the state. And the lion's share of all of those jobs have been within the $10 an hour to $14 an hour band. So what that does is that squeezes the job opportunities available to middle income folks or to folks who have the skills and qualifications for higher earning jobs.
How about outside of Atlanta? You studied income inequality statewide. Look at Cordele, Georgia. Median household income, a little over $23,000 a year. That's less than half of Atlanta's median income. So what does income inequality look like in these smaller towns across the state?
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously more concentrated in smaller and more rural parts of the state, but they're still wrestling with some of the same barriers, the systems barriers that we're dealing with in a bigger place like Atlanta. For example, I would name like housing in a place that's, you know, more rural. You know, there are parts or pockets across the state in more rural areas where folks are having to work a minimum of 80 hours a week, at a $7.25 minimum wage just to afford a two-bedroom apartment. And this is in places like Chatham County in Southwest Georgia and all across the middle Georgia area as well. So I think that in the rural places, we are seeing and need to lift up and highlight that they are facing and wrestling with some of the same challenges that we're seeing here in our more urban centers like Atlanta.
So, Marissa, you have been part of drafting legislation with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to introduce a postal bank. How would establishing a retail bank in the postal service locations help address these kind of issues of income inequality?
I'd like to talk about another piece of legislation I worked on with Senator Warren, because I think the postal bank is reflective of a particular problem, and that's of the unbanked. Mm-hmm. And what the post office would be able to do is to provide basic, you know, check cashing and, you know, financial services to people who don't have an access to a bank account. That's another different project. But on the racial wealth gap, I've worked with Senator Warren, which she just introduced a bill to talk about housing. Providing capital exactly for this problem. So let's say a place like Atlanta, the bill looks at places that were formerly segregated, like those redlined areas, or places in rural Georgia that formerly, you know, looked at, you know, you look at these segregation maps and there really hasn't been all that much change over time. And so what the bill provides is that you would provide capital for down payment assistance. So one of the problems with the wealth gap is that people just don't have capital, like an initial, you know, they don't have a dad or a grandpa that can give them, you know, $50,000 for a down payment. And so the bill would provide that through public financing and restoring the tax cuts at the top. So we talk about, you know, dynastic wealth and intergenerational wealth. One of the ways that gets passed down is, you know, like the Paris Hilton phenomenon, right? Someone's born into a very wealthy family and they get that huge estate. Now that I think as a recent immigrant, that goes against the American dream, right? The American dream is you work yourself for the wealth. And so we have this dynastic ability to pass wealth down. And so what it does is just restore down to the Bush level tax cuts on that wealth, and provides down payment assistance to people who have been, you know, for generations excluded from these public policy and wealth building programs. And so it remedies that through capital assistance. It offers affordable housing. So one of the biggest problems in poverty is not just lack of housing, but insecure housing. So you've got, you know, kids being thrown out, evicted, you know, changing the location of housing. You know, the schools, you know, are segregated based on, you know, where you live, and a lot is determinant of that. And so the bill really focuses on that. So I've been working with Senator Warren's and several other senators to try to really get at the cause of the problem and to remedy it.
Alex, we have just half a minute left, but I'm wondering if there are other cities that have been successful in closing the wealth gap and lessening income inequality and the kind of things they've done.
Sure. So this is a very broad and very important issue across the country. It's very difficult to actually point to places that on a large scale that are actually doing a great job at closing the wealth gap. But a lot of local places are experimenting. I would look to, in terms of the housing market, Dallas is doing some really incredible things around providing affordable housing and really modeling some of the things that Senator Warren has also presented. Obviously, places like Seattle and San Francisco and LA are constantly in an experimentation mode, not always doing the greatest job, but always experimenting and open to new ideas. So
lots of ideas on the table. Alex Carmardell, Marisa Baradaran, thank you so much, both of you, for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to explore Atlanta's failed Amazon HQ 2 bid. This is On Second Thought.